We've been told our whole life that you need to separate money and emotions. You don't need to make emotional money decisions. I think it's probably the biggest BS advice I've ever heard is, why would you try to separate it? They're there. You can't get rid of it. And if you do, you're just pushing it down and it's going to explode at some point.
Welcome back to the Most Hated F-Word podcast. I am your host, Sean Maslick, and I am delighted you're here for another fascinating conversation. This week, I am happy to have Brendan Fraser on the podcast. Brendan is the owner of Wired Financial Planning and is the host of the wonderful podcast called The Human Side of Money. What I appreciate about Brendan's style of podcasting is he's very curious and he's always trying to find ways which can enhance the human experience of money so that financial advisors, planners, and alike can better understand the human nature, the complexities that money has on our own relationships so that we can ultimately help our clients. This was a wonderful conversation as Brendan did some exercises in preparation for our conversation. Why I think this conversation is so wonderful is it gives you an insight to Brendan's relationship with money, his money story. As a host of a very successful podcast, it is great to see him open up and share this story with us, the listeners, so that hopefully we can begin to reflect on our own stories.
Anytime I feel like I'm doing something counterintuitive to what traditional financial planning would say, I just ask myself, is this decision being made through the lens of something that's important to me? And if it's something that's important that I won't ever regret, I can at least rationalize myself to pull it off.
It seems the culture, the society we live in, talking about our relationship with money, our money stories, is not always widely accepted. So I applaud Brendan for coming on and having this wonderful conversation. Before we get into the episode, which I am certain you're going to enjoy, if you've been enjoying these conversations, you could support the show in one or two ways. You could head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review, or you could send this episode to a family, friend, colleague, or anyone you think would enjoy the episode. Before we get into it, please check out Brendan's podcast, The Human Side of Money. And now, I hope you enjoy this fascinating conversation with Brendan Fraser. Brendan Fraser, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. As we were saying, this is a show that I've put in my newsletter before, think that other people should listen to, I've enjoyed listening to. So to say it is an honor to be here would certainly be an understatement.
Vice versa. Actually, just hearing your voice, it's distinctly different than mine. I live in Canada. I think you're in the southern part of the US.
Yeah, that's right.
I've heard this voice so many times, but we were just chatted to each other. So I think this will be an enjoyable conversation.
Yes, I tend to agree. Yeah, it's kind of funny. You've ridden with me in my car before. So you've been hanging out in my, or your voice has anyway.
So I was just like, I have?
Yeah, sorry. Not technically, not actually, but you've been in my car. Your voice has been in my car. So yeah, this is good. It's exciting. Love the work that you do. I'm quite a bit biased, pretty biased as far as that goes. But I actually remember it was about 2 years ago, somebody that reached out to me on LinkedIn sent me a message and he had a picture. And he sent me a picture, and on this picture was a notepad where he had written down the name of two podcasts. One was The Most Hated F Word. The other one was The Human Side of Money. And so I feel like ever since then, we've been linked in some kind of way. So
interesting. Not just saying this to be polite, because people think Canadians are polite, but we're not all. Over five times, someone has said to me after I've done a podcast, like, wait, do you know Brendan Fraser? I think you guys should be to do a podcast together. So I don't know. Yeah. There's something there, and here we're doing it. And today, we are going to do something that we have done on the podcast a few times, is dive into real-life money stories. And I reached out to you to see if you would be open to this idea, because I feel like I've seen, I guess, your money story or your relationship with money evolve as I've listened to you on the podcast. And I thought it would be neat for our listeners to hear a bit about the guy behind The Human Side of Money, yourself, and a little bit of your relationship with money, because I feel like as we share these stories, often untold stories, listeners start to realize that, hey, no, I have a story about money. I have the same, I guess, complex feeling in and around money. And I struggle with the same things as, say, Brendan in this case. So thank you for playing along today.
Yeah, happy to do it. In fact, it's one of those things where I was just telling you a second ago, but I talk about it a lot, talk to other people about it a lot. But the thing that's easy to do is just kind of like say, oh, I'm talking about it, I'm thinking about it. But sitting down and actually doing a little bit of your own work and your own reflection was, really kind of eye-opening. It was a good exercise for me. And in fact, I'd be curious. You said, you've heard bits and pieces maybe of my story and the evolution of it from the podcast. And so you may even know more. You may even have thought about things that I haven't thought about as I was sitting there trying to go back through it. But yeah, it's one of those deals where it was really eye-opening to me to see the power of sitting there and reflecting on it intentionally rather than just kind of piecemealing it together, being like, oh yeah, this is doing this exercise or reflecting on these memories is important. To do it in an intentional, structured way took me to places that I don't think I've ever actually been before. Helped me connect dots that I don't think I've ever actually connected before as far as my quote-unquote money story goes.
Interesting. So you talk to a lot of intelligent people on your podcast. You yourself are very well researched in terms of what advisors can really help implement the human side of money. But knowing and doing is different. And I hear you saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific example that as you were answering that, you thought about? Maybe talk about one of those dots that you were connecting that this reflection that you spoke of allowed you to actually be aware of and not just, I guess, prescribing, more so being with that dot.
I think what I never really put together or realized is how many different beliefs that I've had around money over the course of my life and how those things have changed. Or maybe I should say how I may have a core, like these core root beliefs that I'm trying to change and adapt from. Like I was trying to think as I went back and reflected, and one of the questions was, what would you name your book? The thing that I kept coming back to is it would have to be something about that encapsulates like the wandering or mixed messages or this like ever evolving journey. And the reason I say that is because like I started realizing, well, actually, let me back up and start with this, because I've had people on the show where we talk about money stories and financial flashpoints. And what are these experiences with money that have shaped your beliefs and who you are today? And they're always fun conversations. Meanwhile, I'm over here both during and after those conversations thinking to myself, like, I don't know that I have like these just standout moments. It's really hard for me to come up with like, this was my first memory. This was the most painful or pleasant experience that I've ever had around money. And I feel kind of guilty about it. I'm like, wait, I feel like I need to have these very clear moments where that definitely shaped me. Right. And so that's always been a struggle of mine as I hear other people talk about it. I'm like, I wish I had that clarity. Right. Like I wish I knew exactly what those moments were. So I'm saying that in hopes that if there are other people out there who think like I get it, but for me, it doesn't, like I have a hard time making the connection between my past and my current beliefs that you're not alone in that. So with that as the backdrop, I tried to spend some time really thinking through it and realized that, you know, I growing up, I think as far as like the beliefs from my family and my parents and then the church that I was raised in, was money was kind of like taboo in a way. You know, I remember the Bible verse that money is the root of all evil. You know, you don't want to, kind of like you don't want to be rich. Not that people explicitly said you don't want to be rich, but when you're young, you sort of interpret scripture that way, or that's how I interpreted it, like it was a bad thing. We didn't really talk a whole lot about money in my household. But meanwhile, we also didn't really want or struggle for much. You know, like I was fortunate enough to go to a private school. You had a car when I turned 16, right? We'd get gifts at Christmas. Like, I don't ever remember really struggling. And so I had this, as I reflected on it, I've never connected this dot, this weird dynamic between, the way that I saw my parents spend was like, you only spend on things that you really need. You don't want to spend on luxuries. You don't want to spend on things if you can save money, why spend it? Then as far as like the Christian background goes, there's the scripture about, you know, money is evil. And that's not how I actually internalized it, but you come to think like, oh, you don't want to have too much money. So I had that going on. And meanwhile, there's this dynamic on the other side where I didn't really ever want for anything. I didn't ever have to like go a night without living out on the street. I didn't ever have to struggle for anything. Like, I'm not saying that everything was handed to me on a silver platter. Like I had to work growing up so that I could or my dad made me work. But it was this weird deal where it's like, we were in a good position, you know, a very fortunate position. And at the same time, I had this other message coming of like, hey, you know, don't spend too much money. Money is the root of all evil. And I've never really sat in that tension going, those feel like two different things. Like we had enough, but we didn't treat it as though we had enough. And basically what you're getting now is me distilling for the first time out loud my thoughts. So that may not be the most concise, the best answer, but that's where my mind's been for the last several hours or so as I've been reflecting on it.
I appreciate that. And what I appreciate in listening is that we often try to understand this, as Neil Beige always says, the human experience of money, but you just talk to the complexity of it. We've got our religious beliefs, our cultural beliefs, our parents, our grandparents, our neighbors, all of these influences that pull us in these competing directions sometimes, like you're alluding to. As you're saying that, and you had talked about what you would call your book, and you said something about wandering, you said it was what you said. Maybe speak a little bit more about why wandering. And what made me think of that is, as you're talking about, there's these conflictions of like, you know, don't spend too much money, but we have enough. And it almost seems like there's this sense of like wandering as you're describing that, of what does this money mean to me?
Yeah. So by wandering, I guess what I mean is I'm looking at it and kind of contrasting where I came from to where I am now and how my views have changed over time. And so I guess maybe the example that I would give is, like I said, the belief I think that I learned, whether explicitly or not, the belief that I learned was like, well, you don't, if you have the opportunity to save money, you save money. There's no reason to, luxury is not really, why would you spend on luxurious things? You don't need the nicest cars. They get you from point A to point B. Drive the car into the ground because it's a depreciating asset, right? Like my family, we went on a trip to New York when I was in high school, and my parents and then three of us, my two siblings and me, there are five of us. Granted, I'm in high school, my sisters are teenagers, and we still only stayed in one hotel room because guess what? You can fit five people in one hotel room if you bring an air mattress, right? And so we're all in one hotel room instead of getting two hotel rooms because practically, if you can do it in one, why would you get two? And so those are kind of, that was sort of my, what I was raised to see around my, and again, now what I've been through as far as like the past several years and learning these things like you are, talking to some awesome people and raising awareness around this, is what I've realized is that's kind of where my beliefs were ingrained, as I kind of started believing that and doing that same thing with my money habits. And then along comes my wife, my awesome wife, who I love dearly, who came up with a different background, who came up where I guess the gist of it, the easiest way to describe it is you'd say like she grew up without getting into the whole backstory, which you can if you want, but basically she was taught that she was given nice things was by her parents. That was how they showed her love in the midst of like some a difficult time in her life. And so she started equating like nice things with love and with status. And so then when they would go on vacations, they would always do like the nicest things, right? So she grew up with that background. So we bring those two worlds together, which isn't probably a story in and of itself. Those two worlds collide, something that we've had to work through and continue to work through to this day. But here's one thing that it did for me, why I say wandering and why I say it's been a journey between my past, the way I used to look at money and how I look at it now, is I still remember for our honeymoon, in my mind, we would go somewhere, you know, pretty reasonable that we could afford, or in my mind afford. And my wife had this one place that she wanted to go to that was more than I could ever imagine spending on a vacation. In fact, I was like, that should be like the annual vacation budget, not like the one-time vacation budget. And so we went at that point, I'm like, all right, well, whatever. It's our honeymoon. We'll just do it. And then never again will we ever spend this kind of money. So we go and we do it. And I remember in the moment being like, wait a minute, nice things are cool, right? Like, why did we not do these nice things? This is awesome. Like the food's amazing. The service is amazing. This is an experience I've never had before in my life. And so now I'm starting to go, okay, maybe it is okay to like pay for nice things. Maybe it's not a waste if you go on a trip to stay in a nice hotel rather than one that just gives you a bed to sleep in and a continental breakfast, because that way you don't have to pay for it, right? And so that's where I think I've seen the most, that's where I maybe evolved the most and had to fight the most, is in this natural tendency to say, why would you pay for nice things when you don't have to? The only way I've been able to sort of like start changing my thinking around it is through being forced to experience otherwise. Like, and that, again, that the honeymoon example is the best one, where I go, all right, I would have never paid for this myself, but because I did, I can now see why this might be worthwhile. I can now see why it's okay to spend money on certain things that you enjoy. It's okay if you can do it, if you can afford it. You don't necessarily have to fly coach. You could fly business class. You could fly first class. Now, quick caveat. I've still never actually pulled the trigger on first class, because every time I walk by, I think that does not look that great. Like, I can't imagine, that does not look like it's worth the cost difference that I looked at. Right. But I try to keep an open mind to this. Like, okay, one day I want to do it, just because I think back to the honeymoon thing and I go, I would have never gone on this honeymoon until I was forced to do it. And now I see why it's worth it. So one of the like tangible reminders to me is when I get on an overseas flight, walking by first class, going, I have to do it one day to continue stretching my thinking, continue evolving, and continue trying to fight this natural ingrained tendency that the less you spend, the better. And anything that's over and above just practical use is a waste of money.
You know, we are joking at the start of people saying, oh, you guys got to talk to each other. How do you not know, Brendan? And as you're describing your background, I feel like you're reflecting my experience with money and my wife's experience with money. So maybe there was this underneath that people knew that we didn't even know. Yeah, and it's conflicting, especially when your worldview is of one thing. I sleep in a hotel and share with an air mattress. And what I find so fascinating about our money stories is often we don't really understand why we think, feel, and do what we do with money. But then you add our spouse, who also doesn't think that. And then you try to make us make mutual decisions. I speak from experience. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
I'm guess what I'm curious here is, your wife is a psychologist, right?
She's a therapist, yeah.
Therapist, okay.
Yeah.
So how did becoming a financial planner influence your conversations with your wife in and around money? So what I mean by that, like who's right?
Yeah, that's a... Talk about a layered question,
That is a 100% curious question for myself, because that's the biggest struggle that I've seen as me as a financial planner who can't have a frugal cult background as well.
My mind goes in a bunch of different directions here. And so I think I'll try to summarize it this way. Number one is, it's the entire reason why, what I experienced is the same reason why therapists say, like, you don't do therapy for yourself or for couples. Like, you can't do therapy on yourself in your relationship. You're too close to it. You're too in it. And so you can't see it objectively. That's why even like marriage therapists go see other therapists, because even though they have the knowledge, they're in too deep. They're too far in it to be able to actually effectively guide themselves through whatever it is that you need to in your marriage. And so that's what my wife is, right? She's a marriage and family therapist. So we like to the point where, you know, well, without getting into marriage therapy in this, but they have these things where they call cycles, where like you can tell, you get to a point in your relationship, or not your relationship, but like in life, where you guys have your tendencies. And so ours is like, let me try to explain it this way. We have our natural tendencies that signal that of what we do when there's some conflict or tension. Like, so for me, when there's conflict or tension, I tend to just go away. I put my head in the sand, and not in the sand necessarily, but I always go, hey, I need time to think and process. I'm not ready to have this conversation yet. My wife thinks that I'm not interested, that I'm just going away. And so she tries to continue to make a big deal out of things. We didn't know this was a thing at first, but we're now to the point where we can recognize when it's happening. But just because we recognize when it's happening and we know exactly what we should do to overcome it, we can't do it every time. We can sometimes, but there's times where we're like, all right, we need somebody to help guide us through this conversation that we're having, help guide us through this tension that we're experiencing. And so what I've realized is that financial planning and our money and our finances work pretty much the same way, where I may know the ways to do things. I may know how to create or set up a system to automate your savings, to, you know, set aside money to go on a trip. I may know the technical way to do things and how to do it and the right answers. But that doesn't mean that it just naturally automatically happens, right? And so what I've come to realize there is that we, just like in therapy, you need a third party. It's best for us to also involve a third party, because when we get too close to doing it on our own, we've gotten better. We've come a long way and tried to be intentional about some things. But for the most part, it just knowing what to do, kind of back to what you said a second ago, just simply knowing what to do and then telling her what to do isn't enough to actually get us what we need. Just like in the communication side from the therapist perspective, we can recognize it in the moment, we can know what to do, but that isn't always enough. You still have to actually do it.
Just you explaining that, I think, is so insightful, because this is not unique to you and your wife. This conversation is something that I experienced with mine. It's when we get, I guess, open enough to share that, hey, yeah, the financial conversations within myself are hard. And then you bring in a spouse, a partner, whomever it is, it becomes very difficult. But that openness I hear you talking about seems to be one of the key, openness to involve a third party, openness to be wrong, maybe. In my views, I know that was a big one for me, that wait, maybe I'm the problem. So Dr. Rick Hansen, I appreciate his work. He wrote a book called Resilient, which is a really, really good book. But him and amongst many other people talk about these inner voices, or this inner critic, the inner child, whatever you want to call it, this inner voice that is often critical. And I find myself in these conversations when, say it's with my wife, when my inner critic, my inner money critic, which I call Mr. Shy, when he's being challenged, I come out to fight, defend, and deflect and prove that she's wrong. And I'll be like, you're a nurse. I'm a financial planner. Here's why I'm right, which I know is not good. But those are the cycles or the patterns. When you took some time to think about if you had an inner money critic, do you feel like you do have an inner money critic? And if you had to name it, if you did have one, what would the name be?
I feel like I might have multiple inner money critics. I feel like there's probably a lot of different voices that speak to money in my head. Real quick, though, I do want to say something about what you said around where you asked, have I ever taken the chance? Or you took a step back and sort of asked yourself, like, maybe I'm the problem. So I think for me, it was a similar scenario where at first I looked at it, and I think from my financial planner brain, what I had learned about money growing up, right? That was like, hey, you don't spend on things you don't need. The whole thing I've already explained. It's a very logical approach, right? It's really logical to be like, well, yeah, a car gets you from point A to point B. It's a depreciating asset. Why would you spend more money than you need to on it? Why wouldn't you drive it into the ground? Yeah, the less you spend on those kind of things, the more you can save, the more you can store up, right? And so I think from a logical standpoint, it's really easy to get on your high horse and be like, look how good I am with money. Look how practical and logical I am with money. And that was the mistake that I made, was I think kind of coming in saying like, well, I'm better with money than she is. I know how to do this. Look, what I do is I know how to save. Whereas, hey, look at her. She's just going out and buying these things we don't even necessarily need. And I guess, I don't know if I ever literally thought of it that way, like intentionally, but as I've spent time reflecting on it, I've had to really challenge myself and kind of, I guess, force myself to sit there and go, is your way better? Or is your way just one way of believing and operating with money? And what is that belief costing you? Right. So it's a question that I heard Ramit Sethi talk about on his show, where, you know, he dives a lot into money psychology stuff as well. And it challenged me a little bit. And he said, take whatever money belief you have and ask yourself, what might it be costing you? And so it's really forced me to open up my mind and go, my belief, the way I view money, isn't necessarily better. It might be more prudent on a spreadsheet, but it's costing me things, just like this, my wife's belief or the way she operates is costing her things. So I think it's just a good question for us to all think through, or to at least come humbly to a conversation, is to say, there is no right way. What's my way? What's your way? What's my way costing me? What's your way costing you? And you can kind of, you have a little bit more empathy in that moment to go, okay, I don't necessarily know. I don't have the right way. I don't have the answers, right? Like, there, you have more empathy and more grace for the person when you don't feel like your way is the right way. Even though I could put it on a spreadsheet and it would look way better, if that makes sense.
I mean, you just touched on this whole idea of the complexities that the human experience of money is. You know the technical way to answer the question, like this money-related question, but is it the right way? You know, when I think I've heard before, you can be right or you can be relational. And I appreciate you saying, like, you know, your wife's perspective or another person's perspective, that's right to them. And opening that, I guess, that thought way that, wait, what is this belief costing me? I think is a powerful question that we all can ask.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could be right. What's it going to cost us?
I didn't mean to dodge your... That's exactly right. I didn't mean to dodge your question around the money critic. That was one thing that you said that I thought was important to come back to. But yeah, so the money critic, again, I think, I don't know that I've pinned it down exactly, but as I was reflecting, thinking through it, writing things down, this is what I came to. And it's something that I want to spend a little bit more time thinking about. But I named my money critic Mr. Tryhard, because this is, again, when I said earlier that I connected some dots that I hadn't really connected before, this was one of them. Because I've always kind of believed that, and probably taking a little bit of pride in, not thinking that you have to have a lot of money. You can be happy. You can be content without having a lot of money. Again, growing up in the church with the Bible around scripture, it's like, learn how to be content no matter what your circumstances. I don't need money to be content. And so I think I've always kind of prided myself on, oh, I don't want to be the showy person. I don't want to show off with money. I don't need a lot of money. But as I started doing some reflecting, I do have this inner belief. And I shortcutted this process a little bit from some of the work that I've done in therapy, where I know that one of the beliefs that I have is that if you want more success, if you want to be accepted, if you want to be loved, you can do more than the other person, then you can achieve more, you can accomplish more, you can get people to like you more. So I've always had this, in my mind, I've had this relationship between effort and output where it's like, hey, the more you do, the more you get. And so the word I noticed, again, through this exercise, what came up for me was, if I believe that the more that I do, the better outcome I'm going to get. What I also know about myself is that I like achievement, acknowledgement, and recognition. And so just being an athlete my whole life, my whole belief was like, hey, I want to be a D1 athlete because that will validate who I am. That will give me some honor. It'll give me an achievement, some prestige. And in order to get there, I need to work harder than everybody else. And by the way, that's also how I was. It's like, hey, if you don't get there, then what was the work for? So in order to validate the work, to feel good about the work, I needed a way to show off like, hey, here was what my hard work got me. I put in hard work. I worked harder than you. And so I got to this place. That's like one example of what that looked like. Now, I'm saying all this out loud, probably thinking, oh, we should edit this because I sound like the most arrogant guy in the world. And I wasn't thinking these things consciously, right? But it was like, if I'm going to put in all this hard work, I kind of want something to show for it. I want people to know that all this hard work that I put in to get the recognition. So now I think about my life today, and I go, all right, now I'm not an athlete anymore, but I still have this belief. And so the way I see it playing out is like, hey, if I'm going to work harder, if I want somebody to see me as being quote unquote successful, whatever that means, there needs to be a way for me to show them. Like, I need them to know that I'm successful. Well, how do you do that? I mean, as we know, money is one of the symbols that can, well, whether right or wrong, oftentimes it's not even accurate, but it's one of the ways that people try to symbolize success. Instead of continuing to ramble, I'll just kind of get to this point, which is, this is the kind of my aha moment that I had where I went, I wouldn't have guessed that I did that. If you had asked me, I'd have said, no, I don't really care about material things. I don't need nice things. I don't care about me. But here's what I do. I don't necessarily want the nicest car. For example, I don't necessarily want a Range Rover. Now, do I think that Range Rovers are awesome? And will I support anybody that gets one that can afford it? Yes. But to me, that's like showy. But what do I want? Well, I do want the nicest Chevrolet Tahoe. So it's like, I'm still showing you that I've done something, that I'm successful. I'm still showing you that I'm worthy without being what I would consider to be arrogant about it. It's like my humble brag with money, essentially, where I go, Mr. Tryhard is, I need to try harder, do more, work harder. That way I can have these outward symbols to show my success. But I'm going to try to do it in a humble way. And like, people will still know that I'm successful, but at least I'm not driving the most expensive car, right? And so I don't really know what to make of all of that exactly, but it was just another one of those moments I had a little bit ago as I was thinking through these things where I went, I wasn't aware of this, or well, not consciously. And now I am aware of it and I'm like, oh man, it was a little bit of a gut punch.
You know, I feel like you could have hopped on here and said whatever you want, but you know, you said, I can't remember, you said a bit embarrassed that you're explaining that you know, you want the recognition that comes with the athletic side, the recognition that comes with the accomplishment. I just hear you being really honest. And I feel like you by no means are the only person who's ever thought that. When my daughter was born, I signed up for a full-length Ironman in the hospital because I wanted the recognition, when I reflected back, the recognition that comes along with like, wow, you have two young kids and you did an Ironman, good for you. So this same thing. I'm going to try. This is my motto as the hardest worker, or tried hard. So I actually understand very intimately what you're talking about. But I think you underpin an important point that I think humans, that we desire this validation to be seen, to be heard. And what I hear, or I feel like I hear what you're saying is these, whether it's this sport or through the Chevy Tahoe, these are ways to fulfill that inner desire to be seen and heard and valued. And we don't always have an answer, but I think it's wonderful when we can use our money stories and reflecting on them as a way to uncover that. Hey, maybe that's what I just want to be seen. I want to be heard. Mr. Shy, my inner money critic, that's all you wanted to do. And, you know, always dancing with it never goes away. But I'm really hearing this underlying feeling that we just want to be seen as humans.
Right. No, I mean, and what you just said brings me back to, or makes me think of a couple things. I think you've had Sarah Newcomb on the podcast, I think, right? So it makes me think back to what she says, where like basically your money, well, how you use your money, how you act with it, what you do with it, it's ultimately fulfilling some sort of fundamental need deep down at some level. And not just money, other things do too. But like, so you, in other words, you can look at your money and trace it back to your needs. And the other thing I think about is an article, I think it was written by Darius Farrow. I'd have to look it up, but around money being the megaphone of identity, where you can oftentimes, like if you look closely enough, if you look at somebody's bank account, you can see that you can basically pinpoint their identity and who they are and what's important to them. Now, the other way I've heard it said is that you give me a look at somebody's calendar in their wallet or calendar in their bank account, and I'll tell you exactly what's important to them. So I think what you just said is right. What you're hearing are these fundamental human needs or desires, or yeah, I guess we call them needs and desires, that are being reflected or amplified through my money story. So what I've done is use my money story to go to backtrack to what are these actual like fundamental human needs. But it's why it's important to be aware of that, because it'll help me pause and go, why is this actually, knowing that, why is this actually important to me? Why is it important for me to have the Tahoe? Is it because if I don't have it, that I'll worry that all the hard work that I've put into building this business won't be justified, that nobody will even know like what I've done? Or do I want people to be like, oh man, look at that. Can you believe, I wonder how well his business is doing. He's got this nice car. He must be killing it, you know? And so I think you're right. Like we can tie how we use money. Money is a tool to do something, fulfill a need, live your life. And so you can look at it, in one of two ways. You can say, hey, what are you using money for? But at the same time, what is it accomplishing? What is it fulfilling? And one of my favorite quotes is, I don't know if it's one of my favorite, but a quote that I like in this, as far as this goes, is from Mark Manson. He says, I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but it's like, in life, either one of two things happen. Either you live it intentionally or it gets chosen for you. Either you choose how to live intentionally or it gets chosen for you. And I think it's the same thing with money. Either we choose to use our money intentionally in a way that fulfills what's important to us, that fulfills our needs in a healthy way, or it will be chosen for us. And meaning these outside influences from life, like our friends, our neighbors, our past beliefs around money, will dictate how we spend it. And it has no regard for how healthy or unhealthy it is to use money that way. Now I feel like I'm off on a tangent, but when you said that, it got me going, it got my mind thinking about all these things. And so, sorry if I went in a big circle there, but I think all that said, yes, I think what this happened with these exercises is that I started with money and it brought me back to just being a human being and the fundamental needs and desires that of being a human being, and how money is, the role that money's playing in fulfilling those things.
I appreciate the response, and you're not rambling by any means. This Mark Manson quote about having intention, so that I can't remember exactly, so that you can influence the direction you're going, or, you know, the external environment can mold you or choose for you, as you said. How, if anything at all, do you navigate being this financial planner who we have these rigid rules of 1 + 1 = 2 versus also embracing this idea that, wait, maybe that equation doesn't always apply to every situation. So my question is, how, if anything at all, do you balance that there are definite rules that a planner wants to plan, but also how do I accept that there's just this unknown to life and that if I plan too much, I might miss like life unfolding in front of me. So how do you, I'm rambling on my question now, but my question is, how do you have the financial planner head that wants to have 1 + 1 = 2, but also open up to that I might be wrong and I might miss a whole bunch of important things in my life? And going back to Ramit Sethi's quote, what's this belief costing me?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a great answer for that other than I think it's come from experience. Like this idea of what looks good on a spreadsheet doesn't necessarily equate to what you should do in real life. In other words, like the first experience I had with that was, and if I could go, maybe the biggest financial mistake that I've made at this point in my life was what I considered to be following textbook advice, which was basically we don't have time to get into specifics. I'd be happy to get into specifics. I'm not avoiding it, but was essentially like fully funding a 401k and an IRA with the savings with this eye on retirement. So I was so focused on the 401k, IRA, that I put very little, no money in a non-qualified account. It's like, oh, if you're set, you know, you've all these reasons to put money into the 401k, you get the tax deduction with the IRA, blah, 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 blah. And so that the non-qualified taxable account, the joint account, that was almost an afterthought. Well, that's great. If you're going to stay in a job or switch jobs and you know, you've got great cash flow all along, it's great to have all your money just earmarked for 59 and a half in a retirement account. Now, I know there's nuances here. There's rules you can get money out, but just go with me for a second. But when you get to the point where you're in a job and you don't love the job and you want freedom and you want flexibility and you have this other business that you want to start, and you've got the idea and you want to make it happen, it doesn't do you a whole lot of good if your money's tied up in an IRA where you have to pay a penalty to get it out before 59 and a half, right? And so I remember thinking to myself like, man, I wish if I could go back in time, I would tell myself, just allow for more flexibility as you figure out the things that are important to you in life. Don't put yourself in, just don't do the technically optimal advice, create more flexibility. That's been a big, I guess, something I've started to preach more and more is you got to create flexibility because we change. People change and we know that. It's called the end of history illusion. We change more in the next 10 years than we ever think that we will. Like we think that we're going to be the same person 10 years from now. We'll come to find out we're way different than we ever think we'll be. All you have to do is go and say, hey, who was I 10 years ago? And what did I find important then? Well, 10 years ago, we didn't have kids. We were newly married. It was 3 jobs ago, right? So things have changed pretty drastically. And so the more flexibility you can build in, the better. You can't tie yourself to the technically optimal answer, the technically optimal response. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say is I think it's just come through conversation with other really smart people and then learning from smart people. Maybe it's Ramit Sethi. The more I did these exercises, by the way, I realized how much of an influence he's had on my thinking. He calls it living your rich life. Talk to Hal Hirschfeld, right? So he's the author of The Future Self, talks about how to make decisions that are better for your future self. And in that conversation, he's like, hey, but hang on. You got to live today too. You can't just live for tomorrow and forget today. And so the way I sort of rationalize it is anytime I feel like I'm doing something counterintuitive to what traditional financial planning would say, I just ask myself, is this decision being made through the lens of something that's important to me? And if it's something that's important that I won't ever regret, that I can at least rationalize myself to pull it off. So for example, is that okay if I give an example?
Yeah, by all means.
All right. A few years ago, I've mentioned this a couple times, not in a while though. A few years ago, we were looking at moving because we had one kid, we were about to have our second kid. We were in this 2-bedroom house, we needed more space. Well, the housing market's booming, especially in Nashville. So we're looking at two different houses we were going to look at to put an offer on. One of them was about $50,000 more than the other one. Okay, so classic Brendan thinking, the typical Brendan, the normal Brendan, the Brendan without intention, would go, well, that's an easy decision. All I have to do is put this in the financial planning software, put it in a spreadsheet, run the numbers, and show you how terrible a financial decision would be to buy a house that's more expensive because look at blah, 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 right? So, and we can do the math on it and everything. But here's what you have to know is that one of those houses was 20 minutes away from both of our grandparents. It was 20 to 25 minutes away from some of my wife's best friends, so some of her community. It was 20 to 25 minutes away from where we spent most of our time and did most of our activities in the city of Nashville. And knowing that family and community are really, really, really important to us, it at least made me pause and go, if I was going to make a financially suboptimal decision, at least on a spreadsheet, it would need to be at a time, it would need to be in a situation where it aligns with the things that are important in my life. And I believe that being near family, especially with kids, and then in community is vital to living a healthy, fulfilling life. And so we bought the house. It was $50,000 more. Now, was it uncomfortable? Yes. Have I gone back and thought about it and gone, what if we would have bought that other house? Yes. But I'll say this. In those moments where we've needed family to come over, where we've needed help, where we get together for events with our family, every single time I think that was worth it. I don't even care. You can show me the spreadsheet. You could tell me that it costs me way more than $50,000 and I would do it again every single time. My wife's friend that lives close by, they were over at our house this past weekend. We're sitting there doing life together and you're like, you know what? This is worth way more than $50,000. So all that being said, how do I rationalize it? It's sort of, ultimately I come back to, if I'm doing something that's in alignment with what I find to be most important in life, I can then justify that it's not spreadsheet optimal. And that's what I mean too. And I say, either living with intention or choosing how it's, if you don't choose how to use it intentionally to be chosen for you, that was an intentional decision of we're going to do this because these things are important. That was a lens that what was important to us, family, community, was a lens through which to make that decision.
That is a great, great answer. And you had said something about, you can go into this specific part of our conversation. You're like, oh, I'm not avoiding that. And what I hear in this conversation is no longer is Mr. Tryhard avoiding the thought that all or nothing, like I'm right. And you know, this, you can't spend the extra $50,000. Your answer just makes me think of like, when you look at research on wellness or happiness, it's very hard to find papers that don't highly suggest relationships, family are such a high indicator to a life well-lived or happiness. So
yeah,
it goes back to this quote that you said is, what is that belief costing you? And children with their grandparents around, the support you have, you can't put a cost on that. So I think it's a really, really good answer. So thank you for sharing that story.
You just said Mr. Tryhard. Because I know I told you that. And as I heard it back, I was like, man, that just doesn't sound very good. You know, like I'm sitting there like, Mr. Tryhard, that's unfortunate. But it's not me. It's my inner critic, right? It's not me.
This is part of us that, you know, is there. So you've really talked, and I appreciate this, Brendan. I can hear evolution of your relationship with money. If your wife was listening to this, what, if anything at all, would she say that she has seen change, be modified in the way that you're relating to money since you guys have been together?
Man, I have an answer that comes to mind right away. I also know, I've heard and kind of believe that oftentimes the first thing that comes to mind may not be like the actual or the best response. Like you kind of have to work your way down to it. But I think it would be what I kind of already alluded to earlier, which is like, I'm more open-minded to spending money in ways that I never thought would be prudent. Like, again, back to the idea of when we go on vacation, being okay staying in a nicer hotel and spending a little bit more money to do that, because I know that that's something that she enjoys. However you want to think of that, however you want to look at it, would be that dynamic of open-mindedness, being willing to be flexible, not being staunch and sticking to this like hardcore belief of saving is better, but being open-minded to trying things and saying, hey, just because it costs more doesn't mean that it's a bad decision. I think that's where she'd say it probably came around the most. The analogy would be like, when we first started dating, I basically ate nothing that was fun. Like my food tastes were pretty minimal, pretty boring. It was like cheeseburgers with no ketchup. It was just meat and cheese. I never really tried any type of fish. This is embarrassing too, by the way, whatever. I never really tried any type of fish. Wasn't very like outgoing. No catfish, right? No, I mean, the only fish I'd really had was shrimp. And so it was like pretty bland and boring with that. And so as like one thing that she did was kind of open up my mind to trying things. And as I tried things, I was like, this whole world was open to me. And so I think that equates directly to my and our relationship with money, where I go, it's been good for me to have her push me a little bit to think beyond how I normally think and believe and feel around money. And so I think that's what she would say is he's come a long way from when we first met, as far as how his open-mindedness around that it's okay to spend money and not in ways that may not be deemed practical. And I had a guy on the podcast, it was an advisor who, it was the same exact thing for him. So for anybody out there that's wondering, is this normal? Is this, I think it's normal, maybe it's not. But I think that's ultimately what she would probably point back to, is how thankful she is that I don't still have this belief that we need to only do what's practical. Let's put it this way. But she would say like this, I'm thankful that when we go on vacation with our boys, we can have two hotel rooms instead of just one.
You know, you say, is this normal? Like, are people thinking? I think what's normal is all of these feelings and thinking in around these conversations. But what often isn't done is having conversations, especially someone like yourself who hosts a podcast on the human side of money, who is a financial planner. I feel like at times we hold ourselves to a regard, or we hold ourselves to a degree, or other people, sorry, to a degree that we're not actually doing ourselves. So I think it's just so wonderful that people like yourself can talk about your complex relationship with money, because it is so complex.
Yeah, no, complex. I mean, I think maybe I like talking about it and I'm open to talking about it because it's, you know, when you host a show and you're putting content out about it, it's top of mind all the time, right? And mm-hmm. So that's what I do try to think about, is what if it wasn't? How do we bring that more into the conversation? Because it's really, really easy, whether you're a financial planner or advisor, or whether you're a client or, you know, an everyday person, it's really easy when you're looking at your finances. When you're sitting down looking at your budget, your numbers, your investment, it's really easy to just focus on the dollars and the numbers and get locked in on, okay, well, what, like, how do we earn more? How do we pay less in taxes? How do we, like, is there ways we could be saving more money? It's and those things are really, really, really important. Don't get me wrong. But I think when you're looking at it in that context, it's really easy to zone in on that and forget, like you said, all the complex stories, all the complex emotions that are right there in the mix, but we try to ignore them. I mean, we've been told our whole life that you need to separate money and emotions. You don't need to make emotional money decisions. I think it's probably the biggest BS advice I've ever heard, is why would you try to separate it? They're there. You can't get rid of it. And if you do, you're just pushing it down and it's going to explode at some point. And so I think it's important to stress, like, hey, you've got to embrace the two, to your point. There are complex money stories. And you have to sometimes say, all right, I'm focused on the logical, rational side, but I need to bring in or be aware of, probably that's maybe the best way to think of it, is I at least need to be aware of what's my money story? How is it influencing what I'm looking at here? Are my decisions being influenced by my money story, my beliefs, my surroundings, whatever it might be?
That awareness, I mean, my Mr. Shy, my inner money critic, I can't get rid of him, but I'm aware now. And maybe Mr. Tryhard, being aware, I think that's a really, really good point. As we conclude here, I have two final questions. The first one is, you're raising two kids. They're watching, observing, waiting to see if there's one or two hotel rooms. Let's use a bit of Hal Hirschfield's work and let's zoom out to, say, you're at end of life. And I ask a similar question, but I'm going to change this question a little bit. Reflecting back, you're at your end of life. Before we ask the kids question, what advice do you think this 110-year-old, however old you're going to be, say it's 100, 110, whatever, what advice do you think he would give you today? So we got Brendan today. Now you zoom out, 100-year-old who's done it, life's about to end tomorrow. What advice do you think he would say in navigating this relationship with money?
Well, mentioning those two kids, or speaking to those two kids that we're raising, one of them the other day told me, Daddy, he's 3 years old. He's like, Daddy, you die when you're 100. So we'll just say I'm 100 because apparently that's when you die.
Perfect.
And I'm looking back, what advice would I give me today around how I view money?
Yeah, is Deathbed Brendan is talking to Brendan, who has like another 50 years, call it, or more. You're not, I don't know how old you are, but.
Yeah. Right, yes.
I don't think you're 50.
A little bit more, not yet. But my first thought was YOLO, right? Just like, if you're on your deathbed, you're like, hey, listen, just live it up, you know, like make the most of every day. But I also think YOLO kind of carries this connotation of like irresponsible living. Like it's like you only live once. So therefore, like you don't need to save anything. So I don't know that I would say.
Can I give an observation and that is coming to my mind? And I don't want to answer your question, but I feel like you've said something without saying it. You know, you talked about the sporting event, like you want to win that D1. I don't even know what a D1 is, but to get to that D1.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. I feel like it's an award or accomplishment or a league or something like that.
Yeah.
But Mr. Tryhard was always focusing on that end goal, that accomplishment. Perhaps Brendan on his deathbed would be saying something along about enjoying the ride. There's some YOLO in there about enjoy the moment, but enjoy the ride.
Enjoy the ride. Yeah. And probably enjoy the ride, try less kind of thing, right? Like enjoy the ride, but I don't know if it's do less or try less, but I think you're exactly right. It would basically be like, hey, that Chevy Tahoe, the nicest Chevy Tahoe that you wanted, the LTZ package, right? As you're on, I'm right here, I'm on my deathbed. Nobody remembers, nobody cares. And the people that did care, you probably don't even know them anymore. So why would you don't put too much stock into that? And instead of focusing on that, did you use your money and your time and your money and your resources to enjoy the ride? Whatever that looks like, maximizing my, you know, time and presence with the kids and living in a passionate, vibrant relationship with my wife where we enjoy spending time together. Maybe not every day, but most days, right? I think that's right. I think that's a good prompt. By the way, I find that when I get asked questions, I enjoy a good prompt. So I appreciate that. Thanks for swooping in there.
I don't like the prompt. I just felt like you had been talking about it. So
yeah, but from a interrelational perspective.
Yeah.
Relationship perspective. Like you saying that to me makes me feel heard and understood, right? So just like, I know we're not getting into that today, but something I think and talk about a lot. It's like, you're pointing out like, hey, I was listening, I heard you. And when I heard it back, I'm like, yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I think that's a great one. Like, I feel like you get me now, kind of thing. So yeah, we'll stick with that. I'll do it with an asterisk, you know? Yeah. And I guess what I'm curious about, I think about this a lot, maybe you have thoughts on this, is do these things evolve? Do these beliefs evolve, right? Like, will enjoy the ride resonate in 10 years the same way it does today, or 20 years the same way it does today? And how do we check in with ourselves on that?
That's a really good question. And if we go back, we talked about Hal a few times. I feel like his work would say, yeah, we do evolve. We become a new self. And
right.
Perhaps it's just more and more of these conversations amongst our inner relationships are required so that we can keep checking in to see how have we evolved. What wisdom do we want from our future self today?
Yeah.
Well, Brendan, thank you so much. This was fun. I appreciate it. You're really honest and open. Not that I was expecting you not to be, but you know, some of this stuff is personal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in my mind, it's like, it's one of those things where people are so afraid to talk about it. And don't get me wrong, there are times where I was kind of like, this is a little bit uncomfortable, but what good does it do for me to harbor it or to keep it in? Like it's real life. These things are happening. Right. So I hope that in some way it helps somebody else gain some insight. I know those are the things that are most helpful for me, is when other people take a step out, they have the courage to talk about something and you go, you know what? I appreciate that. That helped me see things differently. Or at least I'm not the only one, right? Mm-hmm. I do feel a little pressure on that. It's like, I feel like given what I do and the fact, since I'm a financial planner, my wife's a marriage therapist, it feels like we should have the money in the marriage thing like on lock, dialed in to perfection. And so anytime I'm like, yeah, we go to therapy, it's like, are people going to think that something's wrong? You know, or like, yeah, like we probably could use a little help getting our finances shored up. Like there's certainly some, like right now I need to get more life insurance. I haven't done it, for example. It's like, you feel a little pressure, but I hope if nothing else, there's some people out there who go, okay, whew, all right, at least I'm not the only one. There's lessons to be learned in it.
Lots of lessons, and it's important we share it. If you showed up and be like, I've got everything figured out, I would be like, think you need to go to therapy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So, Brendan, this whole time, you have been not only sharing your money story, but you've been writing a song. Now, I don't know if you like to sing or not. In this case, Root Hub is going to sing this song, and he's been listening for the past 57 minutes and crafting a song on the spot in Hawaii, where he is, and he's going to share it with us now, as long as the internet didn't cut out over there. Root Hub, you still with us?
Yeah.
He is. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Well, I feel the need to apologize now for, I mean, no one's ever said, you know, Brendan's really good at being concise with his words. It's literally a phrase that I've never heard in my life. And so I forgot you were doing this. I would like to apologize now for the fact that there are probably multiple times where you were like, hey, Brendan, could you have dialed that in a little bit more, making your job harder on you? But I'm also nervous right now. I have no idea what to expect. It's like they say that anxiety and excitement are, they're related. They're like brothers or they're twins where it's similar chemicals being released. I think I'm excited, but I'm also a little bit nervous.
I mean, it's a very vulnerable thing to put yourself forward to be reflected like in real time by somebody you've never met.
It is not
lost on me at all. Like luckily Sean and I have been doing this for quite a while now. And you know, I like to talk story too, as my teachers out here, we call it talk story and just kind of go on and on. But, That's the beauty of like refining things. So you can refine it into like a little bop now. See if it resonates.
Let's do it.
And I feel it's like surfing, you know. We really never know what's gonna come out as well. So the kind of nervous energy of this is mutual. I'll be picking up on that too. So here we go. Try Hard has a story he believes that the more you do, the more you will receive. Oh, but who you are and what does your life say? When all the cheers and the accolations fade away, all the wandering starts again. The deeper understanding begins. The wandering starts again. Or you might know all the answers. It doesn't mean you know the way. Still gotta take every little step every single day. Are you to venture to the deeper parts of life? Or to walk in the direction of where you open up your eyes? All the wandering starts, yeah. Deeper understanding begins. All the journey to the truth within. The wandering starts again. Come a long, long way since the very start. Mr. Tryhard opened his wallet and it opened up his heart. Now we all have stories that we believe. Or do they add to the strife of your life, or do they relieve? If you feel like you want to live your life in a different way, start your expedition with the first step today. All the wandering stars.
our hearts again. The deeper our staring begins. On the journey to the truth within. Oh, the wandering starts again.
That's pretty impressive, by the way.
It is remarkable.
First of all, I think for me, I don't know that I would ever be able to write a song. And if I did, it would probably take about 3 years to write one. So the fact that he like took all that in and wrote it on the spot, I can't even fathom. I can't even wrap my mind around it.
It is remarkable. Brendan, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoy that song. And thanks for sharing your money story with me and our audience. For those who do not know what The Human Side of Money is, this podcast, they should know. No one should know anything, but many of them probably do. But for those who don't, tell them about this great podcast, The Human Side of Money, and all the other great work you're doing.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you again for the opportunity to be here. There are certain things in life that I call no-brainer decisions. We don't even think about it. And so when you reached out, this was one of those no-brainer decisions. I've been looking forward to it. So I just honored and wanted to say thanks again. And then thanks for the work that you're doing as well. So yeah, the podcast, The Human Side of Money, you can find that obviously anywhere. The website's wiredplenty.com. Maybe the most popular thing that we do in addition to the podcast is this monthly newsletter we send out. It's just a collection of articles, podcasts, and videos that focus on the human side, as we call it. And then I'm also active on Twitter and LinkedIn if you want to connect or interact there. So those are I don't think I'm missing anything, but those are kind of the main places where I hang out and put stuff out into the world most of the time.
Great. Thank you. I'll include those in the show notes and hopefully we can get some Canadian subscribers to the monthly newsletter.
You said earlier that not all Canadians are polite. In my experience, that is not true. I don't know that I've met one that's not. Now, I do believe you're probably right, but it's been one of the coolest things about this has been getting to work with and interact with your fellow Canadians. And everybody's been great. They've lived up to the hype. So,
all right. Well, wait till we stop recording and you'll see the real Sean come out. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. Look forward to next time.
Yep.
Thank you for tuning in this week to the Most Hated F Word podcast. That was enjoyable to have a real money story conversation on the podcast. Thank you, Brendan. And please check out his podcast, The Human Side of Money. Until next week, have yourself a good one.
I'm on a mountain without a top. My wealth is measured in how I spend my time. But now I write freedom's story with every breath inhaled. Money is not the boat of life. It's just the wind in the sail.